Morning, everyone. Today's daf in Ksuvos is daf Yud Zayin. Thank the Lubin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is Lin Lizech and Ishmael Liba Gabriela Bashmuel. We started yesterday the second parak of the Masechta. Second parak of the Masechta begins with another case of he said, she said. The marriage terminated, unfortunately, either through death or divorce. And she's either turning to him or to the estate. And she says, look, I was a Basul when we got married. Right, everyone remember? Why is this information up for discussion? Why are we even debating it? Isn't there a ksuba that's written? So as Rashi pointed out back in the Mishnah, we're obviously dealing with a scenario where there was no actual ksuba that was written. And just because there's no document doesn't mean there's no ksuba contract. Ksuba contract is enforced even without the writing of the ksuba, and so there is a ksuva, even though it's not on paper, but there's still a ksuva obligation, and now just the details are up for discussion. So she says, I was in Pesulim when we got married. He said, that's not what happened at all. In fact, this for you, it represents a second marriage. And I married you as a ba'ula. And so what they're arguing about is money. She's claiming that she's entitled to 200 zuz. He's saying, no, you're not. Not 200 zuz, but rather 100 zuz. So who do we believe? So, oddly enough, our Mishnah says we're going to side with him. Now, I say it's odd because in the previous parak, we've been saying time and again, it's a machlokus, but the halakha goes like Rabbi Gamliel, that we normally extend credibility to her. So the first comment the Gemara made yesterday is that our Mishnah is fundamentally different because our Mishnah is talking about Bari Ubari, as opposed to the previous parak where we were discussing she made a definitive claim and he was only just throwing out ideas and theories and hypotheses and he didn't know anything. So that's Bari Vishema, so we're not going to believe him, we're going to believe her. But our Mishnah over here, he's saying something that is what he believes to be absolute. She's saying something which she believes to be absolute. So it's Bari Ubari. And then, as we pointed out yesterday, he's the one holding the money. He's a Mochzak. So The claims are stalemate. He's the one holding the money, so that's why we're going to extend the credibility to him. It's not like we're extending credibility to him. It's really that we don't know. In other words, it's a claim versus a claim, and he's the one holding the money, so therefore he's not going to, we're going to side with him. However, point out the Mishnah, if she brings in witnesses that at the time of the wedding she was a basula, there were and are telltale signs at the wedding that we know that she was a basula, and she brings witnesses to testify to that fact, so then she's in fact entitled to her 200 zuz. Then the Mishnah went on to say that Rabbi Yeshua is going to agree to the following, and nothing to do with marriage, but having to do with kinyanim, having to do with the transaction. A man goes over to another man and says, I purchased a seal from your father, and you should only know, sorry. Let's start off like this. A man goes over to another and says, you know, this land used to belong to your father. Yeah, and you didn't know that. I'm giving you a little history lesson. And I purchased it from him. So Rav Yehoshua says, oh, despite the fact that I haven't been with any of the previous statements that we made, neither in this Mishnah nor in any of the previous Mishnayos, Rav Yehoshua says, in this case, I'm going to agree. Why? So the Mishnah introduces us to a concept, Tapesha Asr Hu Apesha Hitter. Because the same mouth that incriminates you is the same mouth can bring you out from incrimination. So, unincriminate you, if that's a word. But that's the concept of a pesh asr hu a pesh hitter. Rav Yehoshua says that if you're the one who put yourself in the hole, so then you can get yourself out of the hole. To that, a person has namanus, a person has credibility. The Gemara we spent yesterday learning the entire Tezayinim at Aleph, half of yesterday's daf, which is good, just not good enough. Yesterday we went through the first half of yesterday's daf. How is this different than any of the other cases where Rav Yeshua says, no, we're not going to believe her? Meaning in all the other cases, there was a migu, there was some sort of statement that could have made a better argument, could have made a better statement. So why does Rav Yehoshua say that? Pesha asr, pesha hu, pesha hitter, that's a legitimate claim, meaning not just a legitimate claim. That is a credible claim, and we believe the individual. But meanwhile, in all the previous cases, Rav Yehoshua did not extend credibility. And the Gemara's conclusion yesterday, and this is where we ended off yesterday, is that there's a fundamental difference between all the previous cases and this case over here. In the previous cases, the Gemara's terminology, shur shachul afanecha. Shur shachul afanecha means as follows. Something's wrong, and we know something's wrong, and it demands an explanation. Meaning, when they got married, he thought she was a basula. Turns out she's not, and now she's explaining. So now that she has some explaining to do, so it's true that maybe she didn't give the best argument. Maybe she could have given a better argument, but when all said and done, she has explaining to do. That's what's called shor shachul lefanecha. The animals, it's a mashal, it's an analogy. The animal's in front of us and it's dead, and now we just need an explanation of what happened. So, in a in a metaphoric way. So the Gemara is saying same thing with the woman in the previous perek. Something happened, meaning the expectation was she was a pesula. She's not. Okay, now that we're here, what's the explanation? So Rav Yehoshua says, I'm not going to extend her that credibility of, well, she could have made a better argument, because when all said and done, it demands an explanation. Over here in our case, where man turns to another and says, you know, this land used to belong to your father, that didn't demand an explanation. He was the one who forwarded the information. He presented the information. And so therefore, a peshasri or a peshitir is, and therefore he's going to be believed, he's going to have credibility.
And he's getting some benefit out of this. Whatever benefit it is that he's coming up all of a sudden.
Of course. Right, but
what's the benefit for him?
Why did he present the information to begin with?
Absolutely.
Okay, right. Okay, so good. So you and I have, we're both of us a little bit cynical, and we're both of us a little bit suspicious. That's fair. I understand it is odd that he needs to forward this information now. But that's the. I hear you. I do understand the. Right, your question is coming from life experience.
and
yeah, no, I totally hear. I understand. Okay, but that's just a general principle of pesha through a pesha hitter. Okay, we are on the bottom of Tezayin Amud Aleph. I just gave a quick summary of everything we've been doing up. Not everything, but you know, last parak of what we've been doing up until now. Okay, we are in the very bottom of Tezayin Amud Aleph. The Gemara now forwards a question. Okay, let's go back to our mission. Let's again set ourselves up for the Gemara's question. Okay, the marriage terminated. Let's say it ended in divorce. Although conversation could just as well be she's a widow, but the marriage ended in divorce. She's looking at him. She says, "You know, I was a basil when we got married." He says, no, you weren't. This was your second marriage. You were not a basilim when we got married. So, what did our Mishnah say? That we're going to, unless she brings witnesses, we're going to side with him. That was our Mishnah. To which now the Gemara is going to ask a very simple question. What's the default position? Meaning a woman, when she gets married, what's the general default position of a woman getting married? So the Gemara says she's a basula. So that is what's called a rove. Statistically speaking, most women who get married is a basula. So here goes the Gemara. The came in the rove nashim. It's four lines from the bottom. Came in the rove nashim basulos. And he says, kilo asway to my havi. Most women who get married are basulos. And since most women who get married are basulos, so you have what's now called the rove. And isn't the rove going to give us an answer to our question? Meaning it's not a question, but we want to know. What was she at the time of marriage? Was she a basula or was she a bula? They're arguing. They're going back and forth. He has a position. She has a position. Can't rove be the determinant? Now here, just to give you a little behind the scenes in the Gemara, the question is interesting for the following reason. Generally speaking, when we have rove, rove is a concept. Rove is a concept that comes up again and again throughout the Gemara. And rove is a determinant, meaning rove tells us what something is. It gives us the status of something, right? I have three hot dogs, two of them are kosher, one of them is not kosher. They get mixed up together, so you can eat them. And, okay, there's a chumrah that the Ashkenazim have based on the Rashi, that we throw out one of them, but that's a chumrah. But you can eat them. In other words, because rove tells us that the one gets mixed up with the two, that's it. They're all kosher. Okay, they're all edible. Okay, we could quibble in terms of how exactly to say it, but it's all good. Okay, I good. That was that good. Very good. That's 2 days ago already. That's in Daf Yomi. That's the distant past. So, but no. Okay, good. But anyway, but that's. Rove tells us something. So over here, the Gemara is asking, why not use the concept of Rove to tell us whether or not this woman was a basula? Because most women who get married are, in fact, a basula. However, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky, Tosis points this out, we say Rove when it comes to Issa Veheter. We do not say Rove when it comes to money. When it comes to monetary law, Rove is not a principle. Now, just to be clear, meaning when you go to Beis Din, and Beis Din has to make a decision, and Beis Din is going to have to count, the judges. You know, judges, each one of them has a vote, and you go to a Beis Din of three, and each one of them is going to get a vote. Obviously, you go with the majority. That's not what we mean. What we mean when we say that by money we don't go by Rove, it means that we don't look at statistics to tell us whether or not this money should go to him, this money should go to him. Because whenever you're checking from somebody, it's not enough to just simply say, you know, statistically you should owe me that money. That's generally not enough. What you need to say is, you owe me that money. Either you have documentation with witnesses, or you have actual witnesses. You need to prove positive that you actually owe me the money. So the idea that the Gemara is asking over here, well, statistically speaking, more women who get married are virgins than non-virgins, and therefore she should be entitled to the money. Generally, by money, we don't go by rov. Tosos on the bottom of this Amud is sensitive to this. It's a short Tosos, and he kind of deals with it in two lines, but it's something to think about. Leka Edim, I'm sorry. Kevin de Rav Nashon Basulos Nisus Kileka Edim Ayhave, Larav Parich de Isle Hochim Mamamanach Rav. So Tosos says that this discussion that we're having over here is only according to Rav. Meaning, it's a machlok, it's between Rav and Shmuel, whether or not by monetary law we follow a rov. Rav says we do, and Shmuel says we do not. Now, in generally speaking, in a machlok between Rav and Shmuel, when it comes to monetary law, we normally follow like Shmuel, not like Rav. So it is interesting, because Tosus basically says that this discussion of the Gemara that we're about to have right now is according to Rav, who we do not follow the halacha like. Okay, there's more. There's a lot more on this topic, on this discussion. Tosus Yishanim, you can take a look over there. Anyway, but just making us sensitive to this idea that rov is not something that we normally ascribe to monetary law. Anyway, back to our Gemara. So the Kevin de Rav Nashon Basulos Nisus Kalos Edem Ayhavi. I'm Ravina Mishum de Iklamema Rav Nashon Basulos Nisus Umir Amanus Vecholanisus Basula Yeshla Kol. So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why the rov over here is not applicable. It's not applicable for the following reason. It's true that when a woman gets married, they normally get married as a basula. That's the majority. But also, what's also equally true is that when they get married as a basula, there's a kol, meaning people know about it. Weddings, chasnas, you know, especially, I know we live in a world where, you know, there are chasnas, thankfully, there are chasnas all the time everywhere, and okay, another chasna. But in the good old days when there was a chasna, that was exciting. It was an exciting occasion. Everybody knew about it. What the Gemara refers to as a kol, meaning there's a voice. It carries. So now over here we have a woman who's making the claim that she wasn't a basula. Sorry, she was a basula. So the Gemara says, but at the same time, how come nobody knows about it? How come nobody's talking about it? How come there are no witnesses? So on one hand, yes, it's true that the majority of women who get married are basula, but it's also true that anyone who gets married as a basula also has a kol. And because this one doesn't have a kol, so we no longer have a presumption or assumption that she was a basula.
So the have a kol.
Just 1 second. Just let me just get through the exchange. E kol hanisei basula yesh la kol ki asa de demayhave. So the Gemara says, okay, but did you hear the way with the Gemara presented it? Every basula who gets married has a kol. Everyone. So the Gemara says, if that's true, ki asa de demayhave. So the Gemara says, okay, now let's say she brings out the witnesses. And the witnesses say that she is, and the witnesses say that she was a basula at the time. So what do I have now? I have her witnesses, and her witnesses are contesting what? A chazaka, a general presumption that had she been a basula at the time when she got married, there would have been a kol. And Rashi writes, second line of Rashi, came de chazaka yesh la kol, harbe hayodim. Since it's a chazaka, it's a presumption, and again, very often there's a time that when you have a chazaka, an established presumption, so you follow that chazaka. So even if she brought out witnesses, so what? The chazaka is that there should have been a kol and there wasn't. So the Gemara just simply tweaks it a little bit. So that's the conclusion of the Gemara's question. The witnesses are lying. El amarava rov hanisei besul yesh takol v'zu hol ve'in lakol yisrael ruba. So the Gemara says no. It's not an established presumption that every single besula that gets married has a kol, but it's a trend. It's a tendency, meaning that most of the time when a woman gets married and she was a basula, people know about it. And, Alec, to answer your question of who knows about it and how do people know about it, stay tuned. A good portion of today's daf is going to be dealing with this issue of who makes these announcements at the chasna. Well, I know it's a little bit strange, but to answer it simply, it's going to happen. Meaning there is a declaration at the wedding. It's not blatant. You know, we'll see later on this morning. No one's going to actually declare that. Although there is a reading of the ksuva, but that's a different discussion for a different time. Anyway, it's a trend. It's a tendency. Most of the women who are basulas that get married, there's a kol. That doesn't mean every single one, But over here, it is curious. What it allows us to do is at least say, look, it's a curiosity. We know that you're claiming that you were a Basul at the time. But at the same time, there's no kol. No one heard about it. First time we're hearing that you're a Basulah, it's odd. It's strange. All that does now is it just simply takes away that established rov. Meaning it's true majority of women get married to a Basulah, but at the same time, we don't have a kol that you got married as a Basulah. And therefore, all we're doing right now is... Now we're only left with the claims. You say you were a Basulah, he says you were not a Basulah, and all we have now are left are the claims. And now you want to take money away from him, and we go back to Hamotzi Mechaveh Olavaraya. You need proof positive to take money away from somebody. Okay.
Did you claim that he wants to take money from her because he would end up giving her half?
No, but he's not taking money away from her, meaning the Ksuba is a settlement where he has to pay her. So that's money coming out of his pocket to her.
Right, but if he says she's not a Betula, then he pays half.
Correct, because he feels that he's right. Now, again, it's a dispute. In other words, there are two claimants.
Yeah, but each one is trying to extract from the other.
No. She's extracting from him. He's the one. In other words, whenever...
He has possession
of the money. He is a current possessor of the money. So when dealing with extraction, you look at who's the possessor and who's trying to extract. She's extracting money from him. Again, I understand. Your point is that she has a ksuva. And that's a note. And that's an obligation. But and that's true. And often is a time in halacha where the note is also an item of possession, meaning you can transfer notes, you can buy notes, mm-hmm. and that's true. But when we're talking about the money, we're looking at him as being the possessor of the money. Yeah, in other words, no, that's not a rove. That's always. That's an absolute. But in other words, but all he has is a claim. In other words, he doesn't have evidence that she got married before. He's just saying, this is what I think, or this is what I know. They're claims. It's his claim versus her claim. So again, so who do we believe? So they're both making claims. Each one of them believes that they're both correct. So we then go with who's extracting money from whom. Okay, let's go on to the Gemara. Gemara has such a basic question, which true of the matter is, this is true by any outstanding obligation, but we're going to be discussing in the context of Ksuva. Question of the Gemara goes as follows. Look, what's happening right now? She's taking him to Beis Din because she wants a Ksuva, which she's perfectly entitled to. Gemara is just curious now. How is it that she doesn't go to this Beis Din? Demand him to come to Beis Din, subpoena him to Beis Din. Fine, they have a debate about whether or not he owes a ksuva or not. He doesn't owe the ksuva. They both agree he owes. Just a question of how much. Good, so they go to this Beis Din. Beis Din adjudicates, he pays, okay. Now remember, Armish is talking about where there's no actual ksuva document. Right? That's why they're having this debate. So now, a week from now, a month from now, even a year from now, she'll take him to another Beis Din. Subpoena him to the other Beis Din. Now, mind you, by the way, there was no central communication between Beis Dins, so she'll take him to another Beis Din. And she'll say, you know, he owes me the ksuva. Oh, well, what? Right, you turn to him and said, well, is that true? He says, well, I already paid. Right, in other words, and they'll say to her, well, don't you have a ksuva document? She'll say, look, but I didn't have... In other words, she didn't the ksuva document to extract from the first Beis Din, so why can't she just simply subpoena him to another Beis Din? And have him and have him pay again. What's to stop her from doing that?
Aiden.
Well,
he might have
Aiden. Well, okay. And I mean, Danny, you're right, but he's going to have to bring Aiden every single time she. And the answer to your question may be yes, but so simple question. Amar Rabbi Abba was somewhere else kosher and shover. So Rabbi Abba says, okay. So what we have to do is we have to write a receipt to the man. Now, those of you who've been daf long enough, you'll know the Gemara Baba Basra, Rashi over here cites it very briefly. Writing receipts, yes or no? Major debate in the Gemara Baba Basra. The Gemara Baba Basra says, although writing a receipt is a great way to show proof positive that you paid off an obligation, at the same time, writing a receipt is also very difficult. It's onerous. Because if we have a policy of we have to write a receipt every time you paid off an obligation, so that means then that to protect yourself, you have to hold on to the receipt to protect yourself. Okay, I know we no longer live in a world where we save receipts. Okay, remember the good old days? Okay, maybe some people still save receipts to this day. But anyway, But if you had to hold the receipt every single time you paid off an obligation, so then that means now the burden is on you to hold that receipt. And the Gemara Baba Basra says that there are many Amoraim who are of the opinion that as a policy we do not like receipt writing. The Gemara over here says that in this particular case, in order to protect the man, so if he's going to pay off the ksuva, and remember, we're talking about a case where there's no actual ksuva document, so now she could just go from basin to basin demanding the ksuva from him, so the answer over here is, we're going to write a receipt for him. Okay, that's one answer. Rav Papa Amar b'malkum shein kosin ksuva askina. Now Rav Papa says, we're talking about in a place where they don't normally write a ksuva. Meaning that our Mishnah is talking about a location where the minig was not actually to write a physical ksuva. Not to say he's not obligated. Of course he's obligated. But they didn't actually write a physical ksuva. But in other words, our Mishnah over here is not representing the normative approach to ksuva. Normally ksuva is written on paper, held by the woman. But I'm just talking about a location where there's no ksuva. Now, how exactly does that help our question, right? Because the question was, well, why didn't she just go to a second basin or a third basin and keep trying to extract money from him? So stay tuned. The Gemara is going to ask that later on. Okay, anyway, so question, answer. Question, how do we prevent the woman from going from one basin to another and keep demanding the ksuva payment from him? Answer number one, we'll write him a receipt. Answer number two, I'm just talking about a specific location, but generally speaking, we're talking about where ksuvas were written, and generally speaking, if ksuvas were written, so therefore the only way she can demand her ksuva is only if she has the actual documentation. Okay. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to go over the same Q&A, but instead of looking at our Mishnah, we're going to turn to a Braisa, and the Braisa over here is going to be a little more specific, as you'll see in just a moment. As you'll see right now. Ivdik suvasa, hitmenuk suvasa, she lost her ksuva. The ksuva was hidden. Nitzra for ksuva was burnt in a fire. Rakdu lefaneha, shtachku lefaneha, if they danced in front of her at the wedding. In other words, now we're going back to the actual wedding. If they danced in front of her, shtachku lefaneha, evir lefaneha, kosha besura, or they... A cup of good news. You'll see what that means later on. O mapashal basulim, or a cloth that indicates that she was a basula. Imish eidam echa mikol elu, if there are witnesses that can testify that at the time of the wedding there were these very clear, visible, telltale signs that she was a basula. Ksuva samasim, so therefore she's entitled to a ksuva of 200. Okay, so in this braisa, it's essentially the same point as what we learned in the Mishnah. But this braisa, the genesis of this braisa is that there was a ksuva. Right? That's how the braisa starts. Where is it? Lost, fire. It's not here. But there was a ksuva. So the Gemara says, okay, but now that she's lost her ksuva, and she's still entitled to collect, what's to stop her from going basin to basin and keeping demanding a payment of the ksuva? I'm Rabbi Abba. So Rabbi Abba says, okay, so what do you learn from here? That you write a receipt for the husband, and that receipt's going to prevent him from her claiming it again. Rav Papa, I'm Rabbi Malkam Shein Kosin Ksuvas Kinan. Rav Papa says, no, we're talking about a place where there's no ksuva that was written. So the Gemara says, wait a second. Rav Papa's answer works very good in our Mishnah. How does Rav Papa's answer work in the Braisa? The Braisa is talking about whether it was a ksuva. Gemara's next question. The Braisa is talking about a case where she lost her ksuva. Dekasav la ihu. So the Gemara says, well, it's true that she lost the ksuva, but he himself wrote the ksuva. Meaning, the general tendency of that community is not to write ksuvas, but he went out of his way to write a ksuva. So, sof mafkala v'gavyaba. So, the Gemara says, okay, when all said and done, so she's going to keep demanding her ksuva payment from one court to another. My ivda boor. So the Gemara says, okay, what it means lost, it means that it was lost in a fire. So yehachi hainan nisrafa. The Gemara says, yeah, but that's the Braisa says lost in a fire. Va'od hitmina ma'ikal memar. And on top of that, it also says hitmina. So what is that supposed to mean? And the next four words, it's part of the girsa, it's not part of the girsa, but I'll just read it. V'su ivda lamali. And also she lost it. Ela kol ivda kol hitmina b'faneinu dami. I'm sorry, ki in mina befaneinu dami. V'lo yavina la'adama edim nisrafa ksivasa. So the Gemara says, okay, so you know what the pshat in the braisa is? The pshat in the braisa is like this. If the community's minhag is to write a ksuva, the only thing that will allow her to collect the ksuva is the ksuva. Okay? In other words, if the tendency, if the minhag makom is, we write a woman a ksuva, so fine. But that means also that the only thing that will allow us, her, I should say, to collect her ksuva is the actual document itself. What if she lost the document? And then she's in a pickle, then she's in a bind. What's the only thing that will then allow her to collect if she lost her ksuva? Witnesses stepping forward and saying that there was a fire in the house. We saw the whole fire, that the whole house go down in fire. There was a ksuva there. Now, how much they have to see, I'm not sure. But again, the point is that without a ksuva document in a place where we normally write the ksuva, we're going to need witnesses to have to step forward and say that she positively lost her ksuva. However that works exactly. Fine. And then and only then, now that we've determined that she had a ksuva and that she no longer has a ksuva, now it's a question of how much. Then we go back to everything we discussed since the beginning of the parak. Was she a basula? Was she not a basula? If she says yes and he says yes, great. She'll get 200. If she says she was a basula and he says no, so then we go back to, typically we'll extend credibility to him because he's the mukhzak of the money. And then if she can bring witnesses that there were telltale signs at the wedding, she was a basula, so then we'll demand 200 from him. Okay. But when all said and done, it was essentially a little trickier, but it was essentially the same Q&A as we saw back in the Mishnah. Mandi Masnil Abraisa Koshikena Masnisen. The Gemara just simply points out, if Rav Papa and Rabbi Abahu, let me do it in the correct order. If Rabbi Abahu and Rav Papa were giving their answer on the Braisa, they're certainly going to be giving the same answer on the Mishnah. Meaning, again, what were their answers? Their answers were either you write a receipt, or we're talking about a place where you don't normally write a ksuva. So if you're learning it on the if you're learning on the Braisa, for sure it's going to go in the Mishnah as well. Because again, what did the Braisa discuss? The Braisa discussed where there actually was a ksuva. And where is it right now? Well, witnesses reported that it was burnt in a fire or gone. But in other words, the Braisa is starting from a point where there was a ksuva. But if the answers of Rabbi Abba and Rav Papa are going back on the Mishnah, well, I'm not so sure if they're going to say the same thing by the Braisa. Because in the Mishnah, we can easily argue that we're talking about a location where there was no ksuva. But the Braisa is clearly talking about a location where there was a ksuva. So I wouldn't necessarily think that their answers are going to be true for the Braisa if you're learning their answers on the Mishnah. Okay. V'leichushim yesh edim. Now let's go to the next part of the Gemara. V'leichushim ha-mafka edeh heinumna b'hai beisim v'gavya v'ahad ha-mafka edeh heinumna b'veidina achrin v'gavya. So the Gemara says, okay, when all said and done, let's just readdress the same question that we asked before. You told me that what's to stop him from going from one location to another location? Sorry. What's to stop her from going from one based in to another based in and keep extracting that ksuva again and again from him? So the answer was a receipt. Good. Our Mishnah is talking about a case where there's no ksuva documents that are normally written. And again, according to Rabbi Abahu, you write a receipt and that ends the discussion. But according to Rav Papa says, no, our Mishnah is talking about where they don't normally write a ksuva. Okay, but we're still back to square one. If you don't normally write a ksuva, what's to stop her from going from one to another? So the Gemara says, and it's pretty intuitive, but Malcolm Delo Efsher, Vade Kasina Shover. Gemara says, look, if the minhag makom is not to write ksuvas, and there's no note that she is forced to procure in order to collect her ksuva, so that obviously, in order to prevent her from doing this again, you write him a receipt. The machlokus about whether you write a receipt or you don't write a receipt is only in a location where the minhag is to write a ksuva. Then we're going to argue and debate of whether or not you need to write a receipt, you don't need to write a receipt. Okay. Good. From this point going forward, that ends the discussion of the Gemara regarding the claims, the demands, the chazaka, the rov, and all the very basic halachic discussions of Who do we believe? From this point going forward, now we're going to have a discussion in the Gemara about Minhagim. Minhagim and Chasnas. Some of the Minhagim, today's daf, by the way, is a very popular daf. You're going to see some of the lines you're very familiar with in the rest of today's daf, Daf Yud Zayin, as we're about to hit it. Some of the Minhagim we're going to see at the Chasna. If you haven't seen this daf before, so it's going to be shocking to you. You're gonna really wonder out loud, as you'll see. We'll see later on this morning. Like, really, people did that at weddings? Okay, so I'll comment. When appropriate. Like, we don't do that. But some of the monogamy that they used to do at weddings were very interesting. Okay, we start off Heviru lefanei koshel besura. Again, we go back to a wedding, and there were telltale signs that were done at the wedding, which indicated that she was a besula. So one of them was they passed in front of her a koshel besura, a cup of good news. What does that mean? My koshel besura, I'm revada barava, kosyan shel truma ma'avirin lefanei. So they gave her a cup of truma wine. Obviously, this only would be good if she's marrying a Kohen. Right. So in other words, the indication is, Mazel Tov, you're marrying a Kohen. Here's what you're allowed to now drink. Now, Klomer Raya Re'iya Haisa Zula Echol B'Truma. She's fit to eat Truma. So Maskel V'Rapapa, so Rapapa says, I'm not following. The whole point of the Braisa is, this is an indication that she's a Basula. Got news for you. If you have an Amana marrying a Kohen, she's also allowed to eat Truma. Question? Ato Amana Milo Achla B'Truma? Amana's allowed to eat truma. When an Amana marries a Kohen, so you know what she is? Everyone sit tight for this one. She's the wife of a Kohen. And she's also allowed to eat truma. So the Gemara says, I don't understand. How is this a telltale sign? So Allah, Marav Papa, Zu Rashis, Kit Truma. Rashis. So the Gemara says, no, it's symbolic. It means that just like truma is the first portion that we take off of the food, meaning it's Rashis, it's the first. So for her, this marriage is also the first. It's a symbolic act that indicates that she is a besula. Tanya Rav Yehuda Omer Chavishol Yam Avrin Lefaneha. So the Gemara quotes a Braisa by Rav Yehuda. Here's another minhag, which, as you can well imagine and guess, is not practiced nowadays. And that is that a barrel of wine is brought before the newlywed. If she was a besula, so the barrel is a sealed barrel. If she was a beula, the barrel that's passed in front of her is an unsealed barrel. Hamevin Yavin. Hopefully you get the analogy. So amai ne'ever kame besula v'kame beula lo naver klal. Gemara just wonders, it's a strange minhag. Why don't we do the following? If she's a besula, so let's put in front of her a sealed barrel, indicating she's a besula. And if she's a beula, how about nothing? Meaning, how about just not bring it up, not even symbolically? So the Gemara says, "Zim and the Tafsa Masayim va'Amran a besula havai va'haydelo aver kama isnusehu de isnasei." So the Gemara says, "Look, we're trying to give symbolism, like real symbols, that indicates whether she is or she isn't a besula." In terms of proof, so we have a general principle throughout halacha, lo ra'inu ein araya. Right? I don't know if you're familiar with this idea. In other words, the absence of evidence can never be proof. Okay, if we if the claim is, well, there was no barrel, therefore she wasn't a basula. Just because you didn't see it doesn't mean it wasn't there. You can argue that we didn't see it, therefore it's not true. Or therefore something is true. That's not enough evidence in general. Lo ra'inu ein araya. Essentially what the Gemara is saying over here is exactly that. Meaning, for the besula, it's going to be a sealed barrel. That's going to be rolled in front of it. For the be'ula, it's going to be an unsealed barrel. Okay. Why not do nothing for the be'ula? Because if you do nothing, that's not proof. An absence of something is just simply not proof. And her counter argument will be, meaning, imagine, the minhag is to do nothing. So she'll say, I was a basil at the time of the marriage, there was no barrel, you didn't see the barrel. She'll say, an ones happened, meaning, they just, either you weren't there at the time, the people were too drunk, there was a barrel, you just didn't see it. Meaning, you can't trot out evidence of, you didn't see something, and therefore that's evidence. Tana Rabbanan, we're in the very last line of Tazayin Amid Beis. Ketzim Rakhna Lefnei Akala. How do you dance in front of the kala? Now, how do you dance? The Gemara is not going to give us dancing lessons right now. The Gemara is going to tell us, what do you say when you dance? So Beit Shammai Omrim Kala Kamoshihi. So Beit Shammai says, you tell like it is. Lay down the truth. Beit Hillel Omrim Kala Na'a V'chasuda. So all the songwriters follow the opinion of Beit Hillel, which is intuitive, meaning A, it's just that, you know, it goes better, right? Fits in better with the song. And number two, just also nicer. What does Beit Shammai mean when he says, Kamoshi, you tell like it is? So we take a look at Rashi over here, top Rashi. And the Amud, Lefi Yof Yah V'chashivusa Mekal Sanosa. Beit Shammai says, don't mention the negative. It's just that whatever there is to accentuate on the positive, you'll accentuate on the positive. Don't embellish, and certainly don't lie. But, in other words, there's got to be something positive you can find. You'll say that. But don't make this general statement of kalana v'chasuda, meaning she looks great. Right? She looks radiant. In other words, Beit Shammai says, you got to be a little bit more, not a little bit, you have to be more honest and you have to be more specific. Beit Hillel says, kalana v'chasuda, and if you look at Rashi over here, chusho chesem ashoch alaha. Right? She's gracious. But that's it. In other words, according to Beit Hillel, make generic statements, but you don't have to be specific. So Beit Shammai says to Beit Hillel, look, let's say she's blind, let's say she's lame. So kalna v'chasuda, meaning it's obviously, you're obviously embellishing. So v'atarama midvar shaka tirchak. Torah says, last week's parsha. Got to stay away from lies. Amalan Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, Divreicha, Mishlakach, Mekachra, Minashok. Yishabchena Beinav, Yiganena Beinav. Haviyama Yishabchena Beinav. Let's say someone comes back from the marketplace, purchased something that he thought was great. Look at this piece of art. It's unbelievable. And you look at it, and you're thinking also it's unbelievable, but your unbelievable is not the same as his unbelievable. and Beit Hillel says back to Beit Shammai, and what do you expect now at this point in time? You're supposed to tell him that's garbage. That I cannot believe you bought that. No, you make the guy feel good. Of course. And even if that means that you're not telling exactly how you feel, you don't have to make him feel bad over something that he thinks is a winner. Okay, good. Same thing at a wedding. So he is marrying a woman. So say something nice. Don't make him feel bad over his wife. So and the Gemara says over here, life lesson. You should be mu'uravim abrios. You should mix him with the people. Meaning, don't stand out. Don't be overly honest. Don't say it like it is. Meaning pleasantries. Pleasantries is a wonderful thing. And pleasantries mean that if you think that the man's wife is, you know, not the best wife that one could get. If you think that the item he purchased is not the best, don't say that. Be pleasant, be nice. Mu'urav in abrios, you should get along with other people. And yes, even if that means that we're going to embellish and if we're going to extend a little bit. The Gemara in a number of other places, Gemara over here doesn't say it, but the Gemara in a number of other places says, Mishanim Mimnei HaShalom, that you're allowed to lie for the sake of peace and for the sake of preservation of peace. So essentially, again, the Gemara doesn't say it over here, but essentially it's the same idea over here. Meaning, you're right. Is it nice to lie? No, it's never nice to lie. But if you're preserving peace in order to lie, if you're lying to preserve peace, the Gemara gives a number of examples of where we find this to be so. In the Torah, where there was a stretching of the truth, right, an omission, an insertion. So you're allowed to do that in order to preserve the peace. Basically, same thing over here. Ki asra avdi me'amra hachi. So Rav Dimi comes in from Eretz Yisrael and he says, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, when the kala would come down, so this is how we used to praise the kala in Eretz Yisrael. She doesn't need makeup, she doesn't need any type of cosmetics. She's beautiful. Natural beauty. Now this is going to be a little bit, it's going to sound a little bit strange, but there was also, this part's not strange, meaning back in the good old days there was smicha. Okay, nowadays there's also smicha, but it's not exactly the same. Smicha nowadays is just, you know, confirmation that, you know, he's learned a little bit and he knows a little bit of Torah. Okay, that's smicha nowadays. In the good old days, so smicha was that you were part of an unbroken chain going back from generation to generation to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay, smicha was only conferred on Eretz Yisrael, which smicha you were also given certain abilities to adjudicate over matters of money and knas and capital crime. Smicha is a big deal. And by the way, when you got the term smicha, when you got smicha, meaning the smicha, so you were also given the title of Rebbe. We've made this point again and again. It's a very basic point. The Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael went by the title of Rebbe. The Amoraim of Bavel, they didn't go by the title of Rebbe. They went by Rav. Rav is like reverend, right? Back in the day. So I gave the da. I used to give the daf in Deerfield Beach. So over there, there were people, right, Rabbanim, who went by the term reverend. I thought that was the strangest thing in the world, like reverend. I mean, I didn't know that was part of our religion. But in other words, reverend just simply means that, in other words, we revere the individual. He's someone to be revered. But it doesn't mean they have smicha. Just, you know, that's it's an old expression that was used for someone that you should have reverence for. So in Bavel, everyone went by the term Rav. In Eretz Yisrael, you got smicha. You got the term Rebbe. Rebbe Zera, perfect candidate, who we're about to talk about right now, Rebbe Zera made the jump. He went from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael. He used to be Rav Zera, and then he got to Eretz Yisrael, and he got smicha, meaning real smicha, right? From a Masorah going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, so he got the term Rebbe. And at the smicha, right, at the confirmation, at the Chag HaSmicha, if you will, so they sang and they danced and they praised him like a kala at the wedding. So Hitzamcha Rabban Le Rebbe Zera Shalehachi Lo Chav Lo Strak Lo Pirchus V'Yal Aschein. And what song were they singing? The identical song that they sang regarding a kala, natural beauty. Now I know it's funny for a rabbi who just got smicha. It's a little bit strange to say that, but the idea is that. In other words, there's nothing false about him. There's nothing. He's pure. He's absolutely pure. He's got a natural beauty to him. He's got a grace about him. Kisamcha Rabban LaRabbi Ami LaRabbi Asi Shar LeHachi. Gemara tells about other Chag HaSmichas. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi got smicha, and what were they singing in front of him? Kol mundane v'chol mundane smuchu lanan lo tismuchu lanan lo min star misim v'lo min star mitim v'amri lo min ha. I'm sorry, velo min chamisin, velo min tarmisin. So anyone like these two, give him smicha. But don't give smicha to people who are, now we're going to try to explain as many of these as we can, not anyone who are, number one, sarmisin. Rashi says, sarmisin, Rashi's a little bit above where we are in the Gemara, misarsin alachos be'efech tameyah. Has backward logic and backward thinking. Meaning, if the reason and the rationale is not good, don't give him smicha. Next one, sarmitin. Rashi says, like the word smartut. Shmata, a rag. Okay, okay, exactly what that means, I'm not sure, but in other words, he's a shmata. Okay. Just by saying that alone, I kind of get it. Okay, chamisin, omrim chamishis atam. They have a little bit of reason, a little bit of rationale, 20% of what the average person has, however that's measured. And finally, Tormisan Rashi says, at this point in time, Rashi says, I check out. I don't know what that last one is. But either way, the idea is that these, Rabbi Ami and Rav Asi, are great musmachim, and therefore they sang in front of them. And if somebody's not like them, I wouldn't give them smicha. Rabbi Abau ki avei asei mimisivta lebei kesar. So when Rabbi Abau went from the yeshiva to the Beit Kesar, nafkan amasa de Beit Kesar laape. So he was greeted by a chorus of women, and they sang to him. We're not even yet at the strangest part of today's daf. So I'm armed with the information of what's coming up ahead. So to me, this is like, okay, you're right. I just happen to know that there's going to be something stranger coming up ahead. So, which is not me answering your question. It's just me saying, I don't know. So the maidservants of the Kesar would sing to Rabbi Abau as follows. Hachi Rav da Ame. He's a Rav of the people. Umid Barana Duum say. He's a leader of the people. Butzina de Nahora. Brich Masyach Lishlam. Blessed you to the city in peace. I'm a lover. Rabbi Yehuda Bar Elisha. Yanotel. Back to the chasna, back to the wedding. They said regarding Rav Yehuda Bar Ilai that he would take a hadas and he would dance in front of the kala. And he would say that, again, gracious, he would follow the opinion of Beis Hillel with a hadas in his hand. Hadasim in his hand, so it's Rosh Chodesh Adar. Okay, so. It's the time to mention it, right? Esther, Hadassah. But in other words, again, speaking about the idea of a grace, a certain grace. Okay, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And the Gemara says Esther wasn't exactly the most attractive woman, but again, she had chen. She had an attraction about her that goes beyond the.
Gemara says that Esther and Sar were like the most beautiful women.
The Gemara flips on whether or not she was beautiful or not beautiful. That Gemara over there had like a number of issues where they vacillated. It was like a wide range of positions. Right? Ahasuerus was smart. No, he was dumb. Esther was beautiful. No, she wasn't. The Gemara vacillated back and forth on some of those things. Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak Merakid Atlas. He would dance with three. Sounds like he would juggle. And Rabbi Zera says, you know, he was acting very foolishly, meaning like a foolish old man. And really, he embarrassed himself. When Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yitzchak died, that was the quote unquote foolish old man at the wedding. So, if the Kamuda Denura being Didelu Kuleyama, a pillar of fire separated between his burial plot and everybody else. Exactly what that means, don't ask me, but I get the basic gist of the Gemara. The idea is that it's a siman min hashamayim that this was a very special human being. And he looked like he was acting foolishly, but he was totally misunderstood. Meaning, that's a good thing what he did. And the Gemara says, we have a tradition that one or two in a generation get this kind of treatment in their death. And Rabbi Zera learned the lesson. Rabbi Zera says, oh, the foolishness of the old man, meaning that at a wedding he danced in front of the kala. At the time I thought he was looking foolish, but now I realize creating joy and levity at a wedding, that's a good thing. That's a productive thing. And so Rabbi Zera says, I learned my lesson. Three different ways to make the same exact point, but either it was his foolishness, the hadas that he had in his hands, or his shita, or his viewpoint. Either way, so it's all the same point, meaning he was right and I was wrong. Rav Acha would take the kala, put her up on his shoulders, and he would dance with the kala up on his shoulders. And then here we are at the strangest part of today's daf. Okay, so he would take the kala, put her up on her shoulders, and dance with her. So Amalei Rabbanan Maula La Ma'abed Hache. So the students turn to Rav Acha, and the students say to Rav Acha, Rebbe, you know, in other words, we emulate you. In other words, if you do something, so that means that we could do it as well. So the Chassidim say to the Rebbe, okay, no, Rebbe, can we do that as well? So Amar Lahu Idamin Alecha Kekashur Alechaya V'ilolo. And his response is as follows. It depends on how you look at women. If you look at women as beams like I do, so then it's fine. Meaning to me, I don't have a Yetzer Hara. Now, how to understand this Gemara?
Rabbi Yochanan the Mikvah.
Yeah, I understand. How to understand this Gemara? Right, he had a similar statement over there as well. Meaning that he mastered his Yetzer Hara. Generally speaking, that's not something that we normally say in the Gemara. In fact, the Gemara in Sukkah says that anyone who's greater than his friend has a greater Yetzer Hara. Meaning your Yetzer Hara grows commensurate to your greatness. So the idea that he has mastered his Yetzer Hara in of itself is a difficult concept, but that's basically what the Gemara seems to be saying over here. Rav Acha says, look, to me, they're like beams. And so therefore, for me, it's fine. But for you, in other words, you look at women as, you have a Yetzer Hara, and he says, no. You cannot do this. So, do as I say, not as I do. Which I know in general is not a good rule of thumb in terms of education. Okay, but that's basically what he told the students. So one is allowed to look at a kala. Generally speaking, the Gemara speaks very strongly, in very strong terms, about looking at women for the purpose of looking at women, in order to basically feed your Yetzirah. The Gemara says a number of places that that is absolutely forbidden, but the Gemara says over here, if the purpose is to make her more beloved to her husband, so the Gemara quotes an opinion of Rishmo Bar Nachman, that's fine. But the Gemara does not spend much time entertaining this opinion. The Gemara immediately dismisses this opinion as not normative halacha. Okay, let's say you have a strange intersection of a mace and a kala. So in other words, if you can imagine, it's a strange scene, but you're at the, we're going to get to the crossroads in just a moment, because that's basically what we're going to look at. But, and you have one procession of a mace with those who are escorting, and you have another procession of a kala. So, Maravinus amace malefnei akala, v'zeh v'zeh malefnei melech Yisrael. So what takes precedence over what? You steer the mace in another direction so that the kala basically has right away. Okay, or to put it in other terms, kala first and then the mace. And you steer both of them away from Melech Yisrael. Melech Yisrael, in terms of the amount of honor, reverence, and awe that you have to have for Melech Yisrael, so that means that if the Melech has a procession and coming in another direction is a kala or a mace, they get diverted. Amar lav al Agrippas haMelech shavar mifnei kala v'shafchu chachamim. So Agrippas the king, so he was encountering a kala. In other words, the two processions were about to collide with one another, and so he diverted. And the Chachamim said, good job. So the Gemara says, what are you talking about? Look, the leader of the Jewish people is allowed to be Mochus Kava, but not a king. Agrippas, you can't do that. You can't yield to a kala. So the Gemara says that a king is supposed to have awe and reverence by the people, and it's not an option. It's an obligation. So how can Agrippas allow his procession to be diverted for the kala? Answers the Gemara, Parshas Drachim Avai. It was a crossroad. Rashi says it was not noticeable, meaning he was able to turn and steer his procession in another direction, where it was not obvious that he was yielding to the kala. Under those circumstances, it's okay. But if it's obvious and that he's yielding to the kala, so then you're not allowed to do that. Okay, let's do a little bit more for today. One is allowed to suspend learning Torah for taking care of a burial and for a wedding. Gemara says, however, that's only if we have maximum capacity. But once you hit maximum capacity, you're no longer needed, and so therefore you should not suspend the learning of Torah. The kama kol tzarcho, next question. Well, what does that mean? Two versions. Version number one is 12,000 men together with 6,000 people blowing shofar, which was apparently a minute back then for the funerals. Another version is 12,000 men, of which 6,000 of them are going to be blowing shofar. Ula says the formation of a line of people going from the town of Ibula to the town of Sichra, however long that is. Okay. Rav Sheshes v'itim Rav Yochan Amar Netilasa k'nesinasa. Ma nesinasa b'shishim ribu af netilasa b'shishim ribu. The Gemara says that the 600,000, another opinion of the Gemara, just like we got the Torah with 600,000, so when a neshama leaves a human being, and so that's like the Torah being taken away, so and 600,000 is maximum capacity. But then the Gemara contends that if somebody's been teaching Torah to others, So then there is no maximum capacity. Regardless of how many people are there, you still have an obligation to suspend your Torah in order to go out to be mechabed the mace, to honor the dead.